Even before the presidential election of 2016, Russia was all over the news. That trend continues and of late has spread even to movie theaters. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And in this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I will discuss two Russian-themed movies, the English-language political satire The Death of Stalin and the Russian-language drama Loveless. Plus, we'll also tackle another of this year's Oscar-nominated documentary features, Agnes Varda's Faces, Places. So don't touch that dial, because an international conscious Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
Free your radio and hear Spokane Public Radio wherever you go when you listen live on your mobile phone, tablet, or computer at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Just click on Listen Live, pick your station, and start listening. Tune in anytime for NPR programs, local news, music, public affairs, arts news, and more at KPBX, KSFC, or KPBZ. You can listen to all three live from our website by clicking the blue Listen Live link at the top. Whichever station you choose, SPR travels with you, keeps you company, and keeps you in touch with the world. Visit SpokanePublicRadio.org and listen live.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga Law School.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that would broadcast from Florence's Piazza della Signoria if we could, but no. Still, whenever we get the chance, we try to see films that take us to the farthest reaches of the world. Two of the films we will be discussing this week take us to Russia. One, The Death of Stalin, is a political satire adapted from a graphic novel and features a number of notable actors from both sides of the Atlantic. The other is Loveless, a biting commentary on modern Russian life by Andrei Zviagintsev. Then we'll look at Faces, Places, the latest documentary by 89-year-old French filmmaker Agnes Varda. Let's start with a study of what happened following the death of a feared former leader of the Soviet Union. On the night of February 28, 1953, the Soviet Premier, Joseph Stalin, hosted a gathering at his Moscow dacha. Four members of Stalin's inner circle showed up for a night of movie watching, drinking, and the kind of camaraderie that is marked by faux bonhomie, fear, and paranoia. Sometime the next day, Stalin was hit by a brain aneurysm, a fact that no one discovered until hours later, everyone being too afraid to disturb the feared premier's privacy. When they did, a struggle for power immediately broke out. This incident, and what happened next, was the subject of a 2017 graphic novel written by Fabian Nuri with art by Thierry Robin. Working from that comic book source, director Armando Iannucci has crafted a satirical film featuring an international cast including Steve Buscemi as Nikita Khrushchev, Jeffrey Tambor as Georgi Malenkov, and Andrea Riseborough as Stalin's daughter Svetlana. While much of what Iannucci gives us, at least at first, is a kind of dark comedy, the overall tone of The Death of Stalin is uneven to a fault. The satire is unmistakable, especially considering the bumbling of some of the characters, Tambor's Malenkov especially. But the seriousness is real enough, too, with torture and shootings and even one body burned into a cinder mannequin. In any event, The Death of Stalin is a curiosity that might have been more appropriate as a Netflix or HBO original than an actual feature film presentation.
I'm not sure I'm going to agree with you on that last point, Dan, about making it into an extended series.
It could have been just
perhaps,
a standalone movie.
Perhaps. I mean, I'm willing to consider that possibility. But I think my problem ultimately with The Death of Stalin is I thought it started out really well and on a particularly intriguing path in terms of sardonic commentary, slapstick, people bumbling around, this backdrop against sort of what was happening in Russian society at the time and so forth. And then about to me, a little more than halfway through, it kind of fizzled out. It didn't keep up that particular tone, which I was appreciating. And I do understand that maybe in movies such as The Death of Stalin, you need to sort of wax and wane or people will get burnt out.
Literally, in
yeah,
this case.
Yeah, as it turned out, yeah. Yes. And I think that you mentioned the unevenness, and I didn't feel as though it was up and down. I felt as though it was up and then halt. And so that's my critique about the pacing of the film. I have to say that I really did get a kick out of the ensemble cast. And I think that Jason Isaacs shows up as
Marshal Zhukov. He was terrific.
And he was amazing. And the fact that there was no attempt to make people speak with any sort of Russian-tinged accent, Red Sparrow, I am Sparrow, which is probably a good thing. But their English was all across the board. I mean, we had people speaking the King's English. We had people speaking neighborhood New York. And that was across the board.
But that might have worked okay, because remember
no,
that
I liked
Stalin
that
himself
about it.
Was Georgian, right? So he had right. a really different accent than, say, somebody from Moscow.
No, I liked
yeah,
that
so,
about
okay.
it. I appreciated that. And okay. that it was those little things that sustained me through the maybe second, third of the movie when I was just less engaged than I had been previously.
I liked The Death of Stalin way more than both of you, it sounds like. I didn't think that this slowed down at all. I thought that this kind of barreled to the finish line. And in fact, I think some of the biggest laughs happen in the second half of the movie. There's a bit of physical comedy between two characters, one of whom is Steve Buscemi, where he's trying...
playing Khrushchev, yeah, by the way.
Yeah, and doing a great job because he's such a little pipsqueak. It's such a perfect Buscemi role. He's trying to switch places with another character. I can't remember who...
Tambor.
It is Jeffrey Tambor, isn't it? Trying to switch places with him at Stalin's funeral. And that, to me, was one of the biggest laughs in the movie. So I think that what Iannucci does, and we've seen his stuff before, he's most famous for writing and directing In the Loop, which is another really...
Also the television show Veep. Yeah.
In the Loop is another breakneck, foul-mouthed political comedy, and that's what this is too. I mean, he has a wheelhouse, obviously, and he's sticking to that. So you can expect everyone in this movie to be caustic and condescending and just generally awful in every respect. And the dialogue is just expletive laced. And some people don't care for that, but I tend to find that Iannucci uses...
no problem with that.
He uses four-letter words like poetry. Yeah.
Nobody knows how
cases.
Many times we have to bleep you on this show, Nathan. I mean, so
that's true.
You love
yeah,
those words.
Coming from you, that's rich, Dan.
Yeah.
But this movie, The Death of Stalin, is really in the tradition of all of the great black comedies. I mean, you think of something like Dr. Strangelove, which made comedy out of nuclear annihilation, or MASH, which made comedy out of the surgery rooms in wartime, or something like Four Lions, which was a comedy about suicide bombings. And those two things seem diametrically opposed. You think, how could you possibly make kind of a madcap screwball comedy about this era in Russian history? And what I think is particularly brilliant about this film is that it is about a specific time, but it's also about right now. I mean, it is...
No, I agree.
It's about how politics... It's all about failing upward, because in this case, and you can't say that we're not seeing it right now, it's not about who knows best. It's who can sprint the fastest to becoming the biggest sycophant imaginable, because these people, they have no idea what they're doing. And once they're thrown into this situation where they have to act immediately, they bumble their way through it. And I found that... really funny.
Well, I'm going to agree and disagree with you. I mean, there's a lot about The Death of Stalin that I did like. The performances, I think, were terrific, and it is a well-made movie. But to compare this movie to something like Dr. Strangelove, I'm sorry.
It's not as good as Dr. Strangelove, obviously.
But nowhere near
I was using Dr. Strangelove as an example to explain the kind of comedy you're seeing here. Would you say that that's inaccurate?
Yes, I would say that, because it's maybe a movie that attempts to be that, but at least for me, it didn't strike that chord at all.
You didn't think this was funny?
I thought about the first 10 minutes were very funny.
The first 10 minutes?
Yeah. And then there were funny moments all the way through. But overall, was the movie funny? No, I think it...
What?
To me, it was a failure of comedy. It was a failure
of...
You're
kidding.
No, I think it's a curiosity.
No.
I could not figure out what Iannucci was actually trying to do. If he was trying to do exactly what you're saying, I think he failed.
I am so happy to be the person in the middle for once, because I appreciate what each of you is saying. And I guess, Nathan, I would conclude that there were flashes of brilliance throughout, And when Rupert Friend shows up as like Stalin's son, that was so incongruous that it was funny. It was really funny.
And we're making the death of Stalin sound, well, maybe I'm making the death of Stalin sound like it's a laugh riot, but there is legitimate horror in this film.
People are shot right in line.
Yeah, I mean, there is some really brutal stuff in the middle of this political comedy. And the Rupert Friend character in particular, the disdain with which he's met, and he's so pathetic. There's something that's both funny and deeply, deeply depressing about it because he's so ineffectual. He's even more ineffectual than the stupid people that we're watching. Mm-hmm. And I was using Dr. Strangelove as a comparison because I think that's a dark comedy that a lot of people are familiar with. It's obviously not at that level.
And it does.
Most comedies aren't at that
take
level.
Take nuclear annihilation and use it in a way that's hilarious.
And this movie, like Dr. Strangelove, walks that razor thin line between screwball and the horrors of war. So you will get a laugh line followed by, like you said, someone getting shot in the head and then another funny line right after that. And it worked for me. I mean, I thought that the way that he swivels between those two wildly different tones shouldn't work at all. And maybe it won't work for everybody. It obviously didn't work for you. But I was impressed by how deft the handling of this material was because this could have been a complete fiasco.
Oh, well,
just,
I
mean, the basic premise of we're going to make
no,
a,
I agree.
A
Death
a
of Stalin.
Style
I mean,
comedy
let's think about
Stalin.
This.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing that we have not mentioned is Simon Russell Beale, who plays Beria.
Man.
And I
he
really thought that
evil.
He was the sort of quintessential villain, I mean, mm-hmm. on multiple levels. And he carried it off so perfectly.
And interestingly, of all these characters, he's probably the one those of us who lived through this era know the least. Because he was basically erased out of history. But, you know, now we're learning the story of what actually happened. We all, those of us who remember, we all remember Khrushchev showing up at the UN and pounding with his shoe, you know,
right.
and Malenkov. We remember Zhukov. But Beria, this is the story of what happened to Beria.
And you have to admit that regardless of your feelings about Death of Stalin overall, casting Buscemi as Khrushchev is a brilliant.
That was amazing.
I would never in a hundred million years think we could have picked anyone
yes, but
to play Khrushchev. But he does. He pulls it off. And it's, like you said, it's simultaneously ironic and perfect.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's about an era that is long ago, but it's very much about us right now.
And that was The Death of Stalin. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. But before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Loveless and the French documentary Faces Places. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the political satire, The Death of Stalin. Let's now move to a couple of foreign language films, a study of Russian contemporary society titled Loveless, and a documentary road trip through contemporary France titled Faces Places. Let's begin again in Russia. This time, though, instead of the Soviet era, the setting is a modern Moscow housing project. And while the intent of director Andrei Zvagintsev is to comment on modern Russian life, a theme he explored similarly in his 2015 Oscar-nominated film Leviathan, the focus here begins as something far more narrow. Much as Iranian filmmaker Asghar Farhadi did in his 2011 film A Separation, Zvagintsev introduces us to a couple on the verge of divorce. But there are complications. Boris works for a company that disapproves of divorced employees. Also, Boris has impregnated a younger woman, Masha, who is putting pressure on him to cement their relationship. There is the apartment that Zinya and Boris must sell. And oh, there is the 12-year-old son that they have to figure out what to do with. While pretty much any other filmmaker in the world would have centered on the boy, Alyosha, Zvagintsev does not. Like the missing character in Michelangelo Antonioni's film La Ventura, Alyosha disappears. Yet, unlike La Ventura, Alyosha becomes the fulcrum around which the rest of Loveless revolves. Along the way, Zvagintsev gives us scenes of young girls taking selfies, characters talking at length about a kind of unhappiness that borders on the stifling, buildings of relatively recent construction now reduced to waste and decay, all played out as search parties comb both urban forests and brightly lit high-rise apartments for the missing boy, and as television shows broadcast news reports about war in Ukraine and corruption in high places. In the end, Loveless, brilliantly shot, supremely well-acted, and never less than achingly sad, fully lives up to its title. I would just add a qualifier. Loveless, yes, but artful.
It would be somewhat unusual to say that I loved Loveless, but I did. I thought this was a brilliant film on every level. I mean, it perfectly captured the angst and the anger and the
frustration,
you know,
desperation.
The horror of a relationship's ending badly on so many different levels. Again, it could have been shot through the eyes of a child, as we've seen some other movies are wont to do. But no, the child literally and figuratively goes missing. And as you point out, Dan, it doesn't center on him, but he's still the focal point of this movie in this very strange way. I thought the acting here was so realistic throughout, although one character shows up in Loveless and she epitomizes Loveless. And it's the female protagonist, Xenia's mother, who is just, if you think of Tony Soprano's mother, just multiply that by 25, because she was just such a horror show. There was just something about the way this was shot. You know, it's all sort of muted tones and it's all like gray and overcast that just perpetuates this sense of hopelessness and depression and enmity and searching throughout this film. And I don't know, I just didn't know what to expect. It's not upbeat in any way.
It's a punch to the heart and to the soul.
But I was blown away by Loveless.
Yeah, and I think we're not really doing a great job of selling this to middle America,
no.
Are we? I think a lot of people are going to look at the basic premise for Loveless and think, and listen to our comments and think, well, what's the point of enduring a story that's this suffocatingly sad? And this director, Zvagintsev, this is what he specializes in. He's also made films like The Return and Elena
yes.
and Leviathan, all of which are really dour character studies about life in modern-day Russia. And you could look at this, I suppose, as an allegory, in a sense, for the hopelessness of just the Russian existence and the very existentialism that's built into living in Russia at this point. And there's a running theme about the conservatism of Russian society, especially because this couple are divorcing and the husband has to keep it a secret from his job because mm-hmm. the boss has made
He's
this great
Orthodox,
proclamation that, yeah,
right.
you have to be married in order to work there. And
right.
so that just kind of adds to the narcissism of the
well,
entire thing.
When you talked about the allegorical part of it, I thought the metaphor for what was going on really was this search party
mm-hmm.
because it is an amazing assemblage of people who
and
are
And it's
gonna
volunteers.
Look, right,
they aren't.
Who,
it isn't
right.
the state looking
and
for
so,
this
and
kid.
And that's what's so intriguing to me, because it shows you that beneath the surface, people want to come together and they want to do the right thing. Or is this what they're accustomed to doing, coming together and still being searching
and never,
without any resolution,
never getting
without
anywhere.
Any resolve.
Right.
And so I thought that that worked really well, because you do get to know a couple of the primary people from mm-hmm. this search party, but it's really about this group of people who were going to extraordinary lengths to try to find this kid.
And seem to care more about the kid than the actual parents.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
exactly.
Everyone.
And
I think, you know, the person selling the popcorn at the AMC who didn't even see the movie would care more about the kids than did the parents.
And in a subtle way, or maybe in a not so subtle way, depending on how you look at it, I mean, this is really a movie about neglect. And once you meet the mother's
and
mother.
And decay, like moral
yes,
decay.
I mean,
decay,
and how neglect just begets more neglect. I mean, that's what this movie is
about. And
the one
thing that we haven't talked about yet is the way Zvagintsev films this movie. His camera slowly moves and then we'll look at a tape, we'll look at a tree, we'll be standing off and watching people go up and down floors, searching in stairwells, while in the backdrop you see this huge high-rise, brightly lit apartment.
Yeah.
And every shot is pregnant with meaning, mm-hmm. but it may not be meaning that you think, oh, this is going to go somewhere. It doesn't really, but it adds to this overall tone of I'm looking at this world really closely.
And that's indicative of his style. I mean, his movie Elena opens with like a 3-minute shot of an empty tree branch, and you sit there waiting for something to happen. So, I mean, I dig those kinds of movies.
Yeah,
well.
Most
people
do
don't.
I don't usually either, but this one worked for me.
It sucks you in, for sure.
There's the answer to what we're saying. All right, yeah, it's a sad, sad, sad movie. But it is so artfully done that, you know, Loveless is immediately one of my favorite films of the year.
And you're not going to be able to see it in the theater locally,
you're gonna
to
have
the best
to see
of
it
my
streaming.
Knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. And that was Loveless. Let's close with Faces Places. In the realm of French cinema, you'll find a number of women directors who, for one reason or another, never have received the attention they fully deserve. Agnès Varda is one. A contemporary of greats such as François Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard, Varda is best known for a handful of films, four of which, including her 1965 effort La Bonheur, are available in a Criterion box set. In recent years, she has made documentaries such as 2000's The Gleaners and I and 2008's The Beaches of Agnes, which, along with her Oscar-nominated Faces Places, offer both a glimpse of Varda herself and of the France she knows best, largely peopled by the working class. Teaming with the much younger, sunglasses-wearing French photographer J.R., Varda tours the countryside, taking photos of those she meets and talks with, documenting their stories, even as J.R. pastes their likenesses to the sides of buildings, water towers, and in one scintillating instance, a collection of shipping containers. Faces Places is a slow-moving, yet quietly poignant tale of friendship, of art, and of life its very self.
Well, Dan, you're often quite wrong on this show. In fact, you were wrong earlier on this very program. But you guys saw this movie before I did, and you told me, you said you're going to love this movie. Do you recall saying that? You were right. I loved this so much. I loved this from the first 30 seconds. I said, okay, I'm going to love this. And it's one of the best documentaries I've ever seen.
So they had you at
seen.
Bonjour?
They absolutely did, at Baguette. And because it opens with a photo shoot involving a baguette. And the fact that this lost the Best Documentary Oscar, I think it probably has to do with the fact that Varda's films have always played with narrative and documentary and mixing the two, kind of a verite style. I think the fact that there are some obviously scripted moments in this, maybe that's why it lost. No one with any intelligence about cinema could see both Icarus and this and think Icarus is a better documentary. You would have to be insane. But let me get off of my soapbox. A better film.
Yeah, step down. Step down.
I'm stepping down. Faces Places. It's great. See it. Varda has a lot in common with someone like Werner Herzog or Errol Morris in that she finds these fascinating people and captures their essence in a minute. You know exactly who these people are in the way she frames them, the questions that she asks them. These people that she finds, this woman who's the last holdout in these old miners' quarters
that
are going to be knocked down. These goat farmers and the different ways that these farmers treat their goats. The wives of these dock workers and the shipping container montage that you mentioned is stunning. And it also is kind of dealing with Varda's entire career and with the French New Wave movement that she's
because JR sort of epitomizes
yes,
a throwback in
exactly.
many respects.
And he was influenced by her work. And, I mean, she helped shepherd in the French New Wave, but she's never spoken about in the same way as Godard or Truffaut.
Right.
There's a genuine affection between them that you can see. And I guess as someone who has a student group in a different generation, there was so much joy associated with their course of dealing with one another.
And kind of a gentle antagonism.
Right, don't you think? Which was great.
Yeah.
Which was amazing. And I loved this too.
And any movie that takes a shot at Jean-Luc Godard at the end is aces in my book.
Agnès Varda says, I like him. He's a dirty rat. I mean, it is. It is. It is, though. It is about two artists, one at the beginning of their career, one at the end of their career. And it's testament to both of them. And I love this movie so much. Find it. I rented it on iTunes.
A bottle
it's
of
only
wine
about,
and a baguette and some Beau-Sanchez. You need to watch it.
It's only about $5. You're
and
going
it's
to love it.
89 minutes
so
long.
So good.
Yes. And that was Faces Places, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbender, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed The Death of Stalin and Loveless. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevenin for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot in the radio dial, when we'll again confront the ever-changing world of contemporary cinema. Until then, remember these words from the American author Bill Browder. Russian stories never have happy endings. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.